It's great to see you there, Bob. Welcome. Always a pleasure to have you with us at MOI Global. I'm sure most of everyone listening knows Bob by now. He is the founder, president, and CIO of Robotti & Company Advisors, a registered investment advisor based in New York City. Bob invests with a value philosophy, a long-term mindset, and has been an active shareholder as well. He has been on several boards, including the boards of AMREP Corporation, Pulse Seismic, and Tidewater, to name just a few, prior to founding Robotti & Company back in 1983. Bob had been the CFO of Gabelli & Company. Bob, it's always such a pleasure to learn from you, and I very much look forward to this opportunity as well today.
It's so nice to be here with you in the MOI community. So particularly it's nice to be here because I guess I'm really excited. I guess in many ways I'm giddy as a schoolboy in terms of like where things are today. And the reason for that is I think we're at the crossroads of what I think are really some excellent investable universe of companies. And at the same time, investor apathy and therefore mispriced securities. And the compelling universe that I believe exists today really is in what's in the old economy. And therefore, I'm really thinking that calling it the revenge of the old economy is kind of an accurate way to think about this. Okay. So first off, I want to start with interest rates are wrong. and I think that's pretty hard to argue against that. What was it? It's 11 years ago. So it was in 2011 when Buffett wrote in his annual letter to shareholders, and he quoted, the comment that, bonds offered that were promoted as offering risk-free returns were now priced to deliver return-free risk. And that key thing is priced. So valuation matters. And that's a repeating theme you're going to hear from us today. So, of course, we all know that Buffett was he wrong about that? Clearly, the decade didn't turn out the way he anticipated when he said that in 2012. I don't think he was wrong. I think he was just early, right? And that happens to many of us who are value investors. So what happened? Of course, we know events unfolded he probably didn't anticipate, right? So we all know that world governments responded aggressively and appropriately to the world financial crisis. But the problem is, what have they done since then? I'd suggest that there were successive rounds of rate suppression, right? What happened was there was a blip in the economy, there was a geopolitical event, there was a war, there was a taper tantrum, whatever it was, there was some event that happened. And the knee-jerk reaction really was the Fed went out and bought securities. And so therefore, as it did that buy government securities, what does that do? That pushes down rates further and rates continue to decline. And so I really do think you've got this odd thing. I'd actually characterize the last decade almost as like a financial groundhog day. These things happened. The Fed went out and did the same thing. Of course, the fact that markets are where they are today is no surprise based on that fact pattern. So for a decade, what you've seen, of course, is you've seen capital plying into what we would consider crowded trades, lowering yields and creating, we think, valuation risk galore for those that are in glory. But at the same time that capital has been sucked into those crowded trades, it's sucked it out of other things. And what we think is really happening today, it's the myopia of linear thinking, and it's prevalent and pervasive. And that is the presumption that because the decade has been so long a period of time and these trends have been so embedded that therefore people just think, that's it. The past is prologue. This is really what's going to happen. And of course, I'm reminded of the comment that Mark Twain made, and that was that it ain't what you don't know that'll hurt you. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And I think that is prevalent across the investment world today because valuation matters. And I think you've already started to see that. So again, real interest rates have been negative for a while, but what's new today? What's new today is that for the first time in a long time, we've seen pronounced inflation, right? And for a while, investors have put up with this and there's been negative real returns, but they've been relatively modest. Of course, with inflation recently, of course, those negative returns have substantially widened. And so the question really becomes, where does inflation level out? And what happens and where do rates have to go? Is it up a little or is it up a lot? So we think that the current pricing assumes that it's really only going to be up a little, but we'll see where inflation comes out at. And that has very broad implications for the investment world in total. Actually, I'm writing a paper co-authoring with Michael Van Bima, Van Bima Value Partners, on this topic of inflation and the opportunities it's creating and the risks of where they are in the markets. And it'll be hot off the press soon. Anybody interested, reach out to me and we'll be sure to give you a copy. So at Rabati, our goal is to outperform the market over the long term. And the fact of the matter is where the economy has been the last decade has made that difficult, but yet we've still done that over the long term. But to outperform the market, we clearly believe you do need an edge. And of course, I would suggest to you that our edge, we've always talked about the behavioral edge, and that is the ability to tolerate market swings. And clearly that comes since we invest in cyclical businesses. Since they're cyclical, you got to tolerate market swings. However, today I would suggest that we have both the analytical and information edge. And the analytical edge is, I think, more critical. And that analytical edge is we've been investing for 40 years. And we are not under the presumption that what has become axioms in the investing world today, based on the last decade's economy and markets, that really is the new norm. We do not believe that. It's odd. It's 10 years, but it's an anomaly. The decade of the of 2010 to 2019, and then tacked on the pandemic piece, has been a very odd thing. And that's not the norm. And so therefore, that's the real fact that we think that we continue to recognize, and it's critical. The other advantage we have is an information edge. Because as I said, where we think the opportunities are today are in old economy companies. And we think those businesses are radically different. It's been decades where the returns that they've generated are suboptimal. Capital's flowed out of it. All the things happen that happen when you have poor returns. But that's substantially changed those businesses. The information edge is we know those businesses because we've been investing in them for decades. So we know the businesses, we know the industries, we know the managements. So we've also supplemented it, as you point out. We're on the boards of a number of the companies that we've been active in or active owners in, and therefore have the perspective that you also get from the boardrooms from these businesses and understanding that. That's a critical advantage we believe we have. So even among value investors, right, there's a checklist that people have had in the last decade has fixed in their minds that they're absolutely right. You don't want to own cyclical companies. You don't want to own commodity businesses. If it's a levered balance sheet, you don't want to go near it. And obviously, if it's trading at a high, and as a value investor, you wouldn't want to necessarily own it. So we think these are all mistaken ideas, right? The cyclical businesses. The reason we invest in cyclical businesses, that's where we think the opportunities are for mispricing. And so commodities, we've never shied away from commodities. And that's a key component to cyclical businesses. And why? Because the volatility is hyper. Mr. Market is more manic depressive. Opportunities are greater. Leverage balance sheets. It's another thing that scared people away from a number of the companies that we've invested in over the last number of years that have worked out really well. Well, it has too much debt. What is debt today? And it's a very different environment because among all the things that the distortions have caused from interest rates, it also means that debt is very different than it historically is, especially subordinated debt. The covenants on it are extremely light. So therefore, the teeth and the risk associated with debt is really different than it's been. So therefore, it's not a reason to therefore ignore a company that may have leveraged balance sheet. And then, of course, what we're also looking to do always is we're looking to buy a business that we think has a very substantial opportunity for growth. So we're not looking to buy a dollar for 50 cents. Right, we're looking to buy for probably less than that. But more importantly, we're focused on companies where that dollar, we understand and we believe there are dynamics that's going to make that dollar grow from a dollar to two to three to four. So we're really growth investors, posing as value investors, because that's where the opportunities are to find these companies that are far less than what it would cost to replicate that business that have those kinds of opportunities for substantial growth. And then therefore, the idea that you don't want to buy it if it's trading at a 52-week high, we're talking about 5-10 years of when the cycle turns, opportunities that these businesses will have in front of them, and growth in earnings. And so therefore, to sell it after it's doubled or tripled in value, that's just a huge mistake, right? Decisions to sell are predicated on estimations of the future cash flow and your conviction about that. Having become familiar with these companies, there's a risk that we fall in love with them. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think that's the case. It's deep knowledge and information about the companies that's a critical part of our investment decision. So here's Shumter's cycle that talks about cycles. And of course, this isn't just cycles of a company. This is cycles of the economy, cycles of markets. So these things regularly recur and pull capital and therefore have effects. And that pulling of capital then changes the fundamentals. But here we're talking about the business itself and what happens to the company as it goes through these different cycles. And that's what we've been now and for an extended period of time. Many of these industrial businesses that we're invested in, the economy for the last decade, the other part of it is the growth in the economy has been very tepid. So these are industrially sensitive businesses that are going through a period of time where demand is not particularly strong. And so what's happened is they've disappointed. And what that's done is led to a repeated pattern of rationalization, right-sizing, consolidation, repeated by that same thing again. And since it's been such a long period of time, that cathartic improvement in businesses has been substantial. In certain cases, we think there are structural differences to certain businesses that fundamentally change the business and reduce substantially, if not eliminate, the cyclicality to those businesses. I know it's a radical idea, but that's what we really do believe, because that's been the last decade is the culminating event over a very extended period of time. So here I just talked to you about the business and what happens to it as it goes through cycles and how the business, the survivors get much better. They improve their competitive position. The landscape is narrow. Here, it's what the market does in reaction to that. And so there's a cycle that, you know, it's pretty familiar with how when things do well, investors get excited. It's reflected in the stock price. And therefore, if things are poor and the expectation changes, the stock substantially declines. But that's not a linear event. Just like the cycle of Shumter talked about was not a linear event. Those are equal times in each one of those sectors that you talked about. The same thing's true here. And what you've had a decade of disappointment is that you had repeated periods of capitulation, despondency, depression, despondency, capitulation again. And what that does is continues to move stock prices, just like continued Fed intervention moves interest rates down, 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 without regard to resetting where it should be. Here, the same thing, even more, because what's the value of a business is so hard to understand. So the values of these businesses, as they disappoint, continue to depress. So the gap between what the earnings power of that business is and what the market's valuation of that actually grows wider. The opportunity gets better because you're further through the cycle. The risk associated with those companies becomes substantially less, we would argue. So we talked about the information edge that we think we do have. The home building business is something that we've been investing in for 20 years. And this is broadly across that industry. We think we have an excellent source of information, knowledge, experience that forms views and enables us to spot opportunities in the investment business. And as I say, not only is it that investment experience, but it's supplemented by the fact that we're on the boards of a number of the companies that we've been invested in. And the information and knowledge in the picture that you get in totality from that seat with a different viewpoint further rounds out kind of our capabilities and the potential for us to identify interesting companies. So the first company I want to talk to you about is Louisiana Pacific. It's a supplier in the home building business. And as I said, the suppliers have consolidated, the distributors are consolidated, the industry, the land ownership, and the development business has consolidated. So these are fundamentally restructured businesses, we believe. So Louisiana Pacific is traditionally a commodity producer of oriented strand board. Now, look at the results that you see here. That over the last number of years, this company has performed extremely well, right? And today, where is it? It has, it's a mid-$70 stock price, and the stock this year will earn 13 and change. Next year, people say, oh, the commodity price will come down. It'll only earn $8 and change. It has net cash on the balance sheet. And of course, that's because this is a cyclical business and these are peak earnings, and therefore you don't want to earn it. Well, let's look at the facts and let's look at what's changed. And let's say, is that really the case? Or is that what the historical facts were that aren't true today, but that's the investor perception that gives the opportunity? So a base premise of investing in Louisiana Pacific is the core business, and that is home building, because that is the critical component, and that's the demand for their product. And of course, we believe that this industry still looks extremely interesting, right? We invested in it 10 years ago when it was a depressed cyclical business. when people thought you wouldn't build new homes, and we thought, gee, no, this is a normal process, it'll come back. So we still think that that's the case, because why? It's all about demographics. There are more households being formed than we're building homes. And that's been the case for an extended period of time. There's demand for homes in excess of the supply. And even when there's a slowdown in this business, and that inevitably is going to happen. And clearly, you know, one of the headwinds that's obvious is we said interest rates are wrong. Well, that means mortgage rates are wrong. And if mortgage rates are wrong, that means they're going up. So we absolutely understand that that's a headwind that's out there, that, and that we believe actually is going to be great, because that's going to give investors an opportunity. The people who understand the medium and the long-term dynamics of this business and the growth in the business and the restructure of the industry, interest rates are going to be a knee-jerk reaction. People are going to sell these stocks. And that's going to be a mistake, because the earnings of these businesses are substantially less cyclical. The ability for them to manage production, the cash flows and the balance sheets they already have today enable them to be advantageous and opportunistic when those slowdowns might occur. But the base fact is the demographics, people need a place to live. The demand for housing is greater than the current supply. So the industry, again, that's what we're saying. These many of these industries have had structural changes that have been going on for 30, 40 years. And the extended downturn that they've gone through have radically adjusted, where here you have five guys control the majority of the marketplace. And that's on an aggregate basis across North America. When you actually look, because real estate is a local market, when you look into sub-markets, there are fewer competitors who have plants who service a market. And therefore, that industry structure is different than it's ever been. And that's a critical element. The second part is, down below is a chart that shows all the plants in North America. All the plants in North America that can produce oriented strand board today are producing oriented strand board. We're only building 1 million single family homes. That's the 50-year historic number. That is not enough to supply the demographic demand for this business. So you have an industry that it has a consolidated group of competitors, and you have full capacity utilization today, and you have new demands for that product outside of home building, and you have supply that's actually going to be flat to down. Why do we say flat to down in terms of capacity? So that's one of the other advantages here. You have a consolidated group of competitors, and you actually have new uses outside of the historic home building only. And so their industrial uses, actually the number one customer of the oriented strand board business today is upholstered furniture, Ashley Furniture. And so that's a new product, a new demand that wasn't there before. So you get more demand pulling off some of the production here. What you also have is Louisiana Pacific, part of the reason we like it, and that's what we do, is when we look at these companies and we identify cyclical businesses that are interesting, we also look for companies that have specific dynamics that make them even better. And so here, what you have in Louisiana Pacific is for a decade, they've been growing a business that takes oriented strand board and then converts it into a siding product. Siding business is a very different business with much less cyclicality and much higher margins and much more predictability to it. And so, and what they're doing is the way they make that product is they take an oriented strand board plant and convert it. So they take supply off the market. So a market that is operating at full capacity is going to take a plant or two out of that capacity equation. So that's a critical element of even making, not only is this new business one that's really interesting and not at all recognized by investors, but they're also taking capacity out of what was it, the historic commodity business, therefore substantially reducing the commoditization of that business. So it's a win-win on both sides of that equation. As I said, the new product that they've really been growing for a long time is this LP Smart Side. And here, a year ago, for the first time, they broke out the results of this segment. And you can see the results of this segment. This is a growth business with predictability and high returns on capital, right? The revenues have grown at 14% compounded. The EBITDA has grown at 23% compounded. You know, current year, this is a year ago when they released the data. This year continues to be those same trends. This product continues to take share. So what you're really doing is having the conversion of this business also. Louisiana Pacific, instead of being a, quote, commodity producer-oriented strand board, has a growing business of siding. Now, in this business, who are the competitors in the siding business they're taking business from? Well, of course, the premier company in the siding business is James Hardie. That company sells at 20 times earnings and 30 times EBITDA because they've grown revenues and they've grown profitability, and they've done that on a consistent basis. And people identified as a great business with high returns on capital and a barrier to entry. We'd suggest the barrier to entry is getting broken down by the fact that Louisiana has a better product. And it's a better product for a multitude of reasons. One is, since it's made from a wood product, and all the competitors in siding are made from either vinyl, which is a petrochemical, or they're made, Hardie's product is a fiber cement. And of course, cement is one of the largest CO2 producers, you know, on the globe. And so therefore, from an environmental point of view, there's a huge competitive advantage that LP has in their wood product. Other things about it, though, is that wood product is much lighter than that Hardie cement product. And so therefore, it's easier to use. It's easier to cut. So the labor component associated with it is drastically less with LP's product than it is with Hardie's. And that's a key element, because in home building, right, there's a shortage of a lot of things. And one of the shortages is labor. The shortage of labor in that business is dramatic. Therefore, less labor, less skilled labor means that that product is going to sell more. In addition, this sided product can be finished and therefore doesn't need painting. So yet another advantage from a cost and labor point of view when it comes to building a home. This product, once you put it on, you're done, as opposed to you have to come back and do things to it. So therefore, there's huge advantages that their siding product has versus all the other siding products out there. And it's a unique product that only Louisiana Pacific has. And so I've talked about the business and I talked about why, how the business is, I think, is positioned, why the business is going to grow, why the business has consistency to it and the conversion to this new product. And the financial results of this company, it's over the last number of years, it's always had net cash on the balance sheet, and it's been generating very significant free cash flows. And what's it doing with the free cash flows? It's intelligently investing those. It's paying a dividend, but most importantly, it's been buying back stock. It's been aggressively buying back stock when the market says, well, this is a transitory event in these stock. Those earnings aren't sustainable. We believe this earnings are sustainable, and we believe that therefore these repurchases have a huge positive impact on the earnings per share growth. So you've got top line growing, you've got increased profitability, you've got better pricing, you have an industry much less cyclicality because there are many fewer players in it. All of those things we think are being ignored by the marketplace. The next company I want to talk to you about is Westlake Chemical. So Westlake Chemical is a producer of olefins and vinyls. And broadly speaking, we think the chemical business in America is extremely competitively advantaged against the rest of the world. And you already saw that a number of years ago, there were all new petrochemical plants that were built in America. There'll undoubtedly almost be a new round, because why is that? Because the key element of making a petrochemical is the petro input. It's the hydrocarbon input. And what happens is chemicals in America, that hydrocarbon in blue here, you see the inputs, natural gas liquids, ethane, which is a natural gas liquid. Those are things that are plentiful and low cost in America, right? So that versus the rest of the developed world, America has a huge competitive advantage that is lower cost of natural gas that is disconnected from hydrocarbons around the world in an environment today where demand for those things is strong. Because right? You look at pricing in Asia, you look at pricing in Europe for all hydrocarbons are significantly above, in many cases, what the price of oil is. And so, and what you have is an industry that in Europe, you make it from oil, and in Asia, you make it probably from coal. And those, therefore, those inputs are much higher cost. And that North American natural gas is stuck here because you can't get it out. So therefore, there's an extended period of time where that cost differential advantage is semi-permanent in America, and therefore drives, what it does is the pricing is set by those other competitors with higher price inputs. And therefore that margin that the US produces has is expanded. And so that's a key element of why we think. And in the meantime, here's a stock that trades at around $100 a share. We'll earn $15 a share this year. And yes, there'll be some volatility in the earnings for sure. You know, will it earn $10? Will it own $15? We don't know what that is. Cash flows are dramatic. It has a little bit of debt. The borrowing cost is negligible. And critically important here is the Chow family owns 70% of Westlake Chemical. The Chow family has a demonstrated record of redeploying capital and generating great returns. And that's what they're doing. And they're continuing to do that. In the fourth quarter last year, they made two substantial acquisitions. They grew out a lot of their building products businesses further with the acquisition of Boral North America. And then they also bought the epoxy business of Hexion, a UK-based producer. And that epoxy business is really interesting because, once again, it's one of these industrial products that the US is competitively advantaged, that there are three people who have 90% of the market share. So therefore, they have strong positions with strong pricing power, with strong profitability, and the sustainability of that pricing power and those prices. Here's a chart that shows the growth and the volumetric capability of this business over time. And as I said, they just made these two substantial acquisitions that once again grow the business. And we think smart acquisitions, and because of the strong cash flows, the second acquisition they made from cash on the balance sheet, they didn't need to borrow money. So what's the cost of capital? You know, they can take it out of the bank and use that money. So these are the extremely positive value creating transactions, and a family that has a demonstrated record of doing that. Here's a highlight of what we're talking about. Industrial America consolidating down and having subsidized the world for a long period of time by selling products with generating no returns has it's the revenge of these people. Those businesses have now consolidated down. It's a fundamentally different position. So you do see Westlake Chemical here a couple of years ago bought Axiall, who they'd been after for a number of years. And what that did was that very much consolidated both the North American PVC capacity and the North American chloralkali capacity. And so those two fundamental businesses have pricing power, which is also relevant because our paper we were doing with Van Bima talks about inflation and talks about some of the drivers, supply, demand. And this driver is not, everybody says, oh, inflation is really just supply chain issues and that'll kind of correct itself. This is not a supply chain issue. This is a business that fundamentally is consolidated, that the supply of which is controlled by a limited number of people who understand they control the supply and therefore maximize and have pricing power. And what is pricing power? One man's pricing power is another man's inflation. And that's pricing power is sustainable. And therefore, this is not transitory. And so, yes, this may not, you know, I don't know, because of the impact of this company across, you know, the global economy isn't all that great. So therefore, this isn't necessarily going to drive inflation higher. But this inflation is real. And most importantly, the producers who are exercising this pricing power have that and will, and that's a sustainable thing that they will continue to have, given how that industry has fundamentally changed and what the competitive structure of it is. Olin is actually in the chloralkali business, the largest competitor. And here's an excerpt from one of their slides that highlights capacity growth over time, what the expectations are, but more importantly, Olin pointing out our business, we know, has historically been a cyclical business. There's a structural change to this business. Three guys control over 70% of the market. Olin is in the business of making money and figuring out how to do that, and not in the business of producing product. And so that fundamental shift enabled by that industry structure means that the pricing power they have is sustainable. Therefore, the earnings that they're generating is sustainable. That's different. People aren't accepting that idea. The myopia of linear thinking. Everybody knows this is a cyclical business. I'd submit to you, it's at least much less cyclical. Also, these cyclical businesses, there's clearly a heightened concern about climate and sustainability, all of those things. And that's a good thing and a good development. And that's, you won't get away from it. What that does is, we believe, creates barriers to entry. Because normally, high prices, high profits, new capital, new capacity, you don't see that. What you don't see Louisiana Pacific doing, and what you don't see Olin doing, is going out and building new capacity. That's not happening. And they're buying back stock, they're consolidating their businesses, they're doing things that are rational, that are going to add to the sustainability and the growth potential of these businesses, not oversupply the market and go into another cycle. So I've talked a lot about these two businesses, but we think that that story is repeated across many different industries. And we think a critical element is a lot of these are US-based manufacturing businesses. And as many of you know, of course, we've been investors in the conventional oil and gas business for decades, we really do think that North America is competitively advantaged against the rest of the world. We think the demands for hydrocarbons, even as we continue to progress and wean off of them and go to alternative renewable forms of energy, and that's undeniable move that will continue to happen. There's a reliance on those fossil fuels for some period of time to therefore have an economy that works, have homes that get heated, have things, you know, the economy has life that we're used to. And so therefore, United States, North America has this oversupply of natural gas, meaning we're disconnected from the rest of the world when it comes to that. So industrial, energy-intensive businesses, businesses that use commodities, petrochemicals, based in the U.S., have a current identifiable dramatic profit advantage that's sustainable, because you can't get the gas out of North America anytime soon to therefore help mitigate the demand concerns and the pricing that exists other places, and yet what we have today. The last thing I want to close with is stock picking. You know, we think it's also not only the revenge of the old economy, it's a revenge of stock pickers. Because, you know, what's happening, of course, is that capital flows now are through passive mechanisms. And if value and, you know, a lot of these basic businesses are back in vogue, well, how do you do that? You invest through an index. But the dispersion in small cap, the dispersion in between the among the companies, which are the winners, which are the losers, that's going to be very different. They're not uniformly advantaged. There's a very different who's advantaged and who's not. We have the people. We've been doing it for decades. We understand these companies. We own stocks today that are, we think, dramatically mispriced. Valuation matters. Cash flow matters. And so that's what's going to, you know, be recognized. The market is already recognizing it. And the way to do that is not buy the index, buy them all. It's if you can identify which are the ones who are the clear beneficiaries for an extended runway of opportunity, that's the place that's going to have a differentiated return. Thanks, John.
Thank you so much, Bob. Really fascinating presentation. Just a reminder to everyone watching, if you have a question, feel free to click the Q&A icon in Zoom and write us your question for Bob. I love the quote that one man's pricing power is another man's inflation. So you might get quoted on that, Bob.
Okay.
A question on capital allocation here for these companies. And if you want to talk specifically, feel free. But it sounds like M&A that's kind of consolidating has good returns. Share repurchases have good returns. So what would you like to see in the capital allocation mix? And do you think these companies could be even more aggressive on that front?
You know, it's the advantage is that both of those things work, and both of those things work well. I guess which is better, stock repurchase or an acquisition of another competitor? Here I'm trying to say one of the other things is valuation matters. So, you know, if you're trading at, you know, 5-6 times earnings, you know, buying back your own stock is, you know, one economic equation. If you're buying a business, actually, and it has in you know, the timber business, so North American Lumber, you know, one of the companies that we think is really interesting is Interfor. Interfor recently bought companies for 3x EBITDA, and EBITDA is pretty close to a free cash flow number. And so, you know, that's better than buying back stock. And it also further consolidates the business, therefore taking one other competitor out of the industry, therefore probably improving the operating fundamentals. So it isn't, of course, just a 5x versus 6x or 3x, which is a lower multiple. There are other factors. And in many cases, the consolidation of the industries is probably a better thing, because it actually has much more add-on effects as opposed to buying back your own stock is a, you know, is a permanent advantage, but you know, it's kind of limited in terms of it doesn't change the business and the fundamentals, the competitive landscape, where consolidation does do those things.
How do supply chain issues affect these companies and the trend to onshoring, perhaps, as well as we look to have more robust supply chains and some redundancy in there?
Yeah, these businesses in particular, I don't think one way or another, I don't think they're negatively affected by supply chain issues. because the raw materials are all sourced here. The products are all sold here in many cases, right? So of course, some things are exported, and we do think supply chain issues other places may be some better, but more importantly is it's the cost advantage of US producers of some things like petrochemicals or fertilizers or many other basic industries like that, that will mean that there's extra export opportunities. But none of those really are supply chain issues. I guess maybe the shipment of, if you're going to do exports, may have some impact, but that's really not a demonstrable economic considerations for these companies.
One questioner says, I agree about consolidation, inflation, but substitution can counteract this trend, i.e. the user substitutes the use of the consolidated product for a new one. Where do you see substitution risk in chemicals or home building?
The biggest place it could be is the oriented strand board business, right? So therefore, you know, it's a structural product. And of course, it has taken share from plywood. And so, you know, it's been a 30, 40 year phenomena that industry in aggregate has grown because it's taken share for that competitor product. Of course, the plywood product is going to be a tree. It's going to be similar cost structure. So even derivative alternative products have many times similar kind of cost structure pushes on those. So that would be the one where potentially you could see something, but instead they're really the beneficiary because oriented strand board still is like cheaper than many other things because of the nature of the product, right? You're taking trees that are lower quality trees, cost much less money, the logs do, more availability, and you're taking that product and gluing it together and making a structural product that is a substitute for a much more expensive product. So they're the beneficiary of substitution. They're not as much at risk. And the continued growth of the use of that product substituting elsewhere really probably puts more growth to that business than it does risk to that business.
Bob, any further thoughts on the insiders and management at the companies you spoke about? Anything stand out to you in terms of particularly good alignment of interests with fellow shareholders?
So Olin's probably cheaper, right? It really is. It's going to start earning $10 a share on a pretty regular basis. And the stock's a $50, $60 stock. And, you know, the cash flows are extremely strong. So the balance sheet's, you know, in really great shape. And there's plenty of growth to the business, right? The epoxy business they're in has good growth to it. And so many of the attributes of Olin are better. I don't know what Olin's going to do with all that free cash flow. Westlake may be somewhat more expensive, but the Chow family owns 70% of the company. The Chow family has a record of making acquisitions that really accrete value. So I don't know what they'll do. I don't know the transactions they'll do, but I have very high conviction. And that's a critical element, right? If I am saying these businesses are generating free cash, will continue to generate free cash, are not levered, and therefore have the capability to do whatever they want with the money. What they do with the money is going to be part of the critical element of how much value things worth 3 and 5 years from now and how they deploy that. And so therefore, you know, Westlake, we have a really high conviction that there are good people who have the money, who will do things, who would definitely allocate that will grow the value. With Olin, I'm not sure what they're going to do with the capital. So, you know, that's the trade-off there. With Louisiana Pacific, we do also think that the board and the management changed 2-3 years ago. And that's when they started to buy back stock pretty aggressively. And that's when they, you know, also emphasized the separation of the two businesses. So clearly they've got a record of good capital allocation. And critical, what they haven't done with the capital is they didn't go out and they're not building a new greenfield oriented strand board plant. That's not what they're doing. And so therefore, what typically may have happened in these cycles in these industries in the past is not recurring, at least today. That's not to say it's not, you know, won't happen at some point, but building new capacity, that takes 2-3 years. It's not a quick process. So we think the identifiable timeline to do that gives investors plenty of comfort that you're not going to wake up one day and suddenly the monies will have been deployed in something that's foolish. So all of them have, we think, positive dynamics in terms of what they've done with the capital to date and what we think they'll do with the capital.
Terrific. Well, we will leave it there, Bob. I want to thank everyone for listening. And Bob, always grateful to you for your wisdom and insights. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us again at this event.
Our pleasure. Thanks a lot, John. Thanks, everybody. Be well. Stay healthy.
Likewise, Bob. Take care. Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.